I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we'll be discussing If Beale Street Could Talk, the new film from Barry Jenkins, the director of Moonlight, and we're lucky enough to have Barry join us to tell us about the film. And not only that, we've got Kenneth Branagh talking to us about his Shakespeare biopic, All Is True. I know, I couldn't believe it either. Two incredible guests, both tucked into our little show. I'm Jake Cunningham, and joining me is Curzon's own Juliet of Johannesburg, Kelly Powell.
Hello.
It's from Cape Town.
Yeah, it's fine. It doesn't work for the...
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Just go with it. Just go with it. And the Rosalind of Red Hill. It's Culture Whispers, Ella Kemp.
I'm so ashamed. Good morning.
And of course, the Dick of Derby.
Wow.
Stephen Wright is here as well.
All right.
Hey, what is this? Hello. Dick the Butcher.
Henry VI,
part two.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
A classic Shakespearean character.
Our host, Jake, Will from Walthamstow.
Yeah, I like it. Are you from Waltham? No, you're living in Walthamstow.
I live there. Yeah, I'm from Bexhill, so the Bard of Bexhill. Who's to say? We've got to wish a happy birthday to Curzon Soho, which turns 60 this week. It was commissioned by Harold Wingate, who once ran Curzon Mayfair. The cinema opened up as the Columbia on the 4th of February, 59. Then it became the Curzon West End in 85. And in 98, the three-screen cinema we now know as Curzon Soho. And to mark the milestone, we're bringing back some of Soho's most popular films. Across the next couple of weekends, you'll be able to see The Remains of the Day, We Need to Talk About Kevin, and For One Night Only, after sticking around for 6 months last year, we are playing Call Me By Your Name once again as well. And I would love it if any listeners out there who have got any fond memories of Curzon Soho throughout the years, I mean, even if you were there when it opened, we'd love to hear from you. Share some of your Curzon Soho memories with us by emailing podcast@curzon.com.
I saw Lucille Hadzihalievich do a... Q&A about her short films at Curzon Soho during the London Short Film Festival, and she's one of my favourite filmmakers and a very mysterious filmmaker, and getting to see her talk in person and seeing Curzon Soho and the London Short Film Festival kind of facilitate that was a really, really cool moment for me.
There we are. See, if you've got any other memories like that, do send them in, podcast@curzon.com. We'd love to hear your Curzon Soho memories. Maybe one of them will come in the form of seeing The Souvenir, the new Joanna Hogg film, which just won the Sundance World Cinema Dramatic Prize. It's been picked up by Curzon Artificial Eye, and we will look forward to bringing that to you maybe later this year, maybe next year. Who knows how these things work. On with our films, though. If Beale Street Could Talk, Kelly, would you mind telling us a little bit about this one?
Yeah, so this is Barry Jenkins' third feature after Moonlight won the Oscars a while ago. And this is an adaptation of James Baldwin's novel of the same name, set in 1970s Harlem, about two lovers divided by circumstance and sort of how systemic injustice has far-reaching effects, not only for these two people, but their families and just sort of society in general.
Brilliant. I spoke to Barry all about following up Moonlight, how he photographs faces in a very particular way, and a bit about Miles Davis too. So here's Talking Beale Street with Barry Jenkins. So we're delighted to welcome to the Curzon podcast, Barry Jenkins. How are you doing?
Not too bad, man. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So the first line of the film... You ready for this? after the success of Moonlight, looking at your next projects, iron things up, were you asking yourself the same question?
No. You know, I wrote the first draft of this at the same time that I wrote the first draft of Moonlight. So it had been in my head for quite a long time. You know, if I wasn't ready for this, I don't know what the hell I would have been ready for. You know, I thrive, you know, when I'm on set. You know, I like to be in the act of creation, you know. And so I think to have something to immediately go into in the aftermath of all the noise that was in the system following Moonlight was the best thing.
And people might think that it was maybe after the Oscars that you would go into something, but presumably once Moonlight's wrapped, you're already getting into the process of the next thing, because there's a good year of that process.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was still trying to be diligent about, you know, carrying the message of Moonlight, carrying the voice of Moonlight. You know, it's the kind of film that needed to be nurtured into the world. And I also recognized that it was so personal that my voice needed to come with it. And yet at the same time, you know, I never want to be static, you know, I always want to have movement, momentum. And so, yeah, I was already in my head visualizing what a Beale Street Could Talk would look like.
Excellent. And something that Beale Street contains a lot of is these beautiful close-ups of faces in particular. And I was curious, I haven't read the text, but is there an element of Baldwin's text that inspires you and James Laxton, the DP, to approach faces the way you do in the film?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, Mr. Baldwin is very gifted at reflecting the interior life of characters. And I think in cinema, the best way to access the interior life of a character is through the eyes, you know, through eye contact. And yet, you know, cinema, the angles we typically use conventionally are very voyeuristic. You know, you never really look an actor or a character directly in the eye. And yet I think in interpersonal relationships and human contact, you know, that's where the most direct communication occurs. We say things and we talk all the time, and that's very effective and can be persuasive. But I think looking at someone is the most direct way to truly understand, you know, what they're feeling and what they're communicating. So I think when you're taking someone who is so densely packed with interior voice, which is what Mr. Baldwin's literature is, to me, I feel like, you know, it was going to be absolutely essential and necessary to have the actors look directly at the audience at certain moments so the audience could get into that interior life of the character as well.
Mm-hmm. And so often looking down the lens can be something that's going to break the reality of the film for an audience.
Yeah, it's true. It's interesting. You know, it's why, you know, I don't tell the actors when we're going to do those shots. I don't know when we're going to do them. It's only if I can look at the actor and see that the distance, the remove between actor and character has disappeared. It's why, other than Naomi Harris, we never do them where anybody's speaking. Naomi's incredibly gifted, so she can do anything. But you know, it's not even about talent or ability. It's quite an artificial thing to look directly down the barrel of a lens. And yet, I think there are certain moments when, again, the distance between the actor and the character disappears. And at that moment, if, like, something direct is being accessed, and I want to give that thing to the audience. You know, acting is giving and receiving. One actor gives, the other actor receives. They then give back. I think when you're in the auditorium and you're watching a movie, you're right, it breaks the fourth wall. But if the giving is very pure, now the character on screen is giving, the audience is receiving, and they give something back. Mm. Now passive empathy has been made into active empathy. And it's why when we do them, we shoot them at high frame rates, see the 48 frames, 72 or 96 frames, because this thing is very elusive. But if I get 5 seconds of it, now I can make that 15 seconds, 20 seconds. And 20 seconds of sustained eye contact is incredibly powerful. It's one of the ways in which I think cinema can do what literature is so innately gifted at, which is reflecting the interior life of a thing, a feeling, a character.
Mm-hmm. And that's something so powerful about the visuals in the film. And I want to just look at the sound for a moment as well. One of my favorite ever songs appears in the film. That's Blue and Green by Miles Davis. Mm-hmm. But it's used in quite a distinct way. Could you tell me about how that song first appears in the film, or how you got to it, and then how you play with it as well?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite tracks ever, and definitely one of my favorite Miles Davis tracks. And I've always wanted to use it in a film. You know, Sally Potter uses it in Ginger and Rosa very early in the piece. And I was so damn jealous because, like, I wanted to be the one to use that song. And I've been trying to find the appropriate moment. And this conversation that Stephon James and Brian Tyree Henry have, as the characters Daniel and Fonny, seemed very appropriate for it. And I also wanted to, again, you talk about breaking the fourth wall, looking directly at the camera. You know, I'm always chasing literature, and literature is a very active experience. You know, the author describes a smell. Through synesthesia, you intellectually understand what that smells like in your head. A lot of dialogue, you read it on the page, you hear that voice in your head. Everything's activated. If you're in a restaurant reading a book, you stop smelling the restaurant because every sense in your body is activated inward. And so I think with cinema, we're trying to chase that experience. And so I like to think of the auditorium as the inside of someone's head. And got these speakers all around. And typically you watch a movie, you get lulled into watching it a certain way. The sound comes from the front. You know, the screen is in front of you. You're not looking directly at the camera. You're at the actor, you're always outside of them. But this song, Blue and Green, starts out by being played on a record. And we're very diligent about showing whenever the needle is dropped. So you understand the song is playing in the room. I know exactly how it sounds. But then Brian and Stefan are doing this thing where the characters are organically evolving over the course of the scene. They're revealing more of themselves. And so myself, Nicholas Patel, the composer, and our mixers, Annalie Blank and Matt Aguas and Matt Waters, who also mix Game of Thrones, this big show about dragons, but they also do these small Barry Jenkins dramas. I said to them, I feel like now the emotion in the room has shifted and something has changed. And so this song needs to change as well. And so as Nick introduces score, Blue and Green then starts to morph. And now inside of the brain, inside the theater, you're used to the sound coming directly from the front. But as Brian goes deeper into himself and Stefan goes deeper into himself, now that song starts to move and it morphs and it bends. And as this trauma is welling up to the surface, Blue and Green is now swirling around the auditorium. And so I think in those ways, I'm not trying to be manipulative, but I'm trying to use the theater, literally all the surround and the screen, to really reflect the way it feels to be inside these characters' bodies. Because when you read literature, that's exactly what the experience is.
That song's got, it's got two colors in the title. And
it does have two colors in the title, yeah. And those two colors are very prominent in the film. I have not thought of that. You are the first person to make that association. Yeah, you're right, because Tish is always bathed in green, which is a very, in this film, a symbol of life and joy, the more brighter aspects. And of course, blue has a very serious and dark connotation. I think jazz does that very well. Mm. You know, it's a very beautiful art form, very beautiful style of music, but and the texture of the playing can also be quite melancholy. And yes, the film does that as well. Hot damn, I did not make that association, but yeah, I'll accept that.
Brilliant. Yeah. Barry Jenkins, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, bro. Nobody has ever mentioned that.
Oh, amazing.
And I've
thanks,
never thought man. Of it either.
A child is coming. It's your grandchild. I don't understand you. It's your grandchild. What difference does it make how he gets here? The child ain't got nothing to do with that. Ain't none of us got nothing to do with that. That child. That child.
That child. That child. That child.
Get your take your with you.
Okay, so you just heard a bit from a scene where it is revealed that Tish and Fonny are going to have a baby, and this is where we get a lot of the family characters come in. It's a film with fantastic supporting cast. Ella, tell us a bit about If Beale Street Could Talk, where this comes for Barry Jenkins, and maybe your first reactions to it.
So If Beale Street Could Talk comes out after Barry Jenkins won the Oscar for Best Picture with Moonlight in 2016, and that also comes after his very first film, Medicine for Melancholy, in 2008. This is a classic love story. It's, you know, very loosely star-crossed lovers in, as you said, Kelly, 1970s Harlem. And it is just, it's so beautiful. The more I think about this film, the better it gets. And I love the film when I first watch it, and it only grows better because we see so many of these love stories like this, but Barry Jenkins has such a sensitivity to people's faces and their feelings, and that must come as well from James Baldwin's text. I haven't read it myself, but you can feel in the words that Tish is saying, so she narrates it with this beautiful voiceover, you can really feel that there's such a detail for what she's thinking, and Barry Jenkins also translates that visually.
Mm-hmm. And Stephen, you're reading the book at the moment.
I am, yeah.
How
unfortunately,
do you feel it's translating?
I couldn't finish the book before seeing the film, but I almost feel as though that dropped me into it in a really interesting place because I was fully kind of engrossed in this book, and then I saw the film recently. And I think that what you talk about with Barry in terms of the close-ups and the almost portrait-like shots that he sets up of the characters is certainly the most striking kind of visual image of the film, and it really works when you get these kind of intensely complex characters looking at you dead in the eyes, and you get to read their faces, and that's not something that's forced upon us in films very often, that breaking of the fourth wall. However, in terms of the novel, I think that what he does visually and the way he adapts the novel visually is that it's a novel of moments, and it's a film of moments that really kind of hit you in an emotional way. And for me, for instance, it would be in the scene when Fonny first takes Tish to the restaurant in Spanish Harlem, and you Barry Jenkins makes the beautiful decision to slow down a very kind of personal moment between the two of them when Fonny starts to speak Spanish. And Kelly, the line was, I got to see him in his own environment, I think.
Oh, it's in his own world.
In his own world. And, you know, he slows down the kind of camaraderie between the waiter and Fonny. And then the camera just moves to Tish's face and settles on it. And you get to see this kind of adoration that she has for Fonny from across the table. And, you know, love stories that when you're expected to just assume that these two people are in love, sometimes they don't work. But Barry Jenkins knows that he doesn't have enough time to build this relationship over years and years and years. So these moments are so, so important. And he nails it. And you can feel that Tish really, really is in love with Fonny in those moments. And that then makes the rest of the movie a lot more effective.
Yeah, it's such a special moment. When you are with someone who you love and you have your time with them and you know that person as you know them and in those private moments. And it's so wonderful to see them in that other world, and that they receive and give love to other people in such a wonderful way. And it, as you say, it just enriches their relationship because it enriches those characters. And if you believe those characters, you'll believe that relationship.
Yeah.
And underneath this absolutely wonderful romance, there is a quiet rage that bubbles under the entire film.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's not only a movie about this romance and these soulmates who have found each other, but it's also about the ways in which they are denied a life because they are black, basically, in this world. So what I love most about this film is that it's obviously, it's a very politicized film, and it has a lot to say, but it never shouts, and it isn't trying to make sweeping statements about systemic injustice. There is no kind of, you know, message of, like, inciting a revolt at the end of it. It's this movie that, you know, through the close-ups and the portraits of these people that you know in those moments, it's like a connection between the characters and the audience, and you, in that moment, you're like, I know this person and I actually deeply care about this person. And it's through those moments and the light and the joy and the life and the love that weaves the story together, that when something like being wrongly imprisoned because, you know, he was falsely identified in this crime, and how that sort of is the reason why these two people and these families can't live a normal, joyous life. And it's the loss of that joy that I think is most impactful in this film. And then that is what makes you think, okay, this is not right. You know, like, this is something, you know, this world shouldn't be this way. Mm. And it's those moments, that those quiet sort of injustices that you walk away from. You go, like, I want these people to be together and they can't.
Yeah.
I find that in the way that Barry Jenkins directs films, the way that he always frames that injustice and you never forget it, but he has this kind of synesthetic approach with the music and all of the really vivid colours that always make it feel light without making it feel flimsy. And so he'll have, as you said in the interview, the blues and the greens that he brings back in the music, but that really punctuate Tish and Fonny's lives together. And then that bleeds into the sounds and kind of atmospheres of Harlem. And he said it in a couple of interviews. He always uses the word synesthetic, which I find really interesting. He just uses it in a sense to describe the feeling that you get from literature in really bringing you into these people's worlds. But I think you feel that even more in cinema when, you know, lots of people who have synesthesia see colours with music. And I don't have it, but I've never felt it more than with Barry Jenkins films. The same with Moonlight as well.
Mm.
So who do we think this film is for, other than maybe fans of Moonlight who are coming back for another round with Barry Jenkins?
I mean, I think it's for fans of visual cinema. a lot, because it is on its surface a very simple tale, as Kelly and Ella have both said, of kind of star-crossed lovers. But I mean, this is a man who knows how to work a camera, and it's a man who knows how to tell a story visually without it being kind of bloated or so obvious. I would compare his the cinematography in this film to the films of Wong Kar-wai, films like Chungking Express, which use kind of like close-ups and kind of blurred colors, and films like In the Mood for Love as well, which are just so like melancholic and doomed, but at the same time it's that kind of love that makes us feel alive. And I think that Barry Jenkins is kind of forging this career as a filmmaker who is becoming, he's becoming an auteur that people want to see what he's going to do next. And I think for fans of cinema in general, I think it's a really exciting time for Barry
Jenkins.
There's
also an element of melodrama in this as well, you know, Douglas Sirk. Especially with like the colours and the story
And the cast. We haven't had time to talk about the incredible supporting cast that kind of makes this film sing, but you know, they're a huge part of it. And there's definitely a melodramatic aspect to it that some viewers might find a bit off-putting, but I think if you can get into the film's rhythm, there's a very rewarding kind of aspect.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Up next, All Is True. Stephen, could you tell us a bit more about this Shakespearean tale of global destruction?
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah, I've been bored watching. I went to see this last week and interviewed Kenneth Branagh afterwards. Sir Kenneth, by the way, which you forgot to add the sir earlier, so he's going to come after you for that. But All Is True is a film that kind of is centered around the last few years of Shakespeare's life, or the last decade of his life, really. But we get to see the first couple of years after his career is over. So the first image of the film is the globe burning down, which is a very kind of obvious but also striking metaphor for the end of this man, this incredible kind of artist's career. And we follow him back to Stratford, where he attempts to come to terms with the end of his career and also reconnect with his daughters and his wife, who he's kind of neglected for a long period of time. And we get to see how he does that. And we get to see like a semi-fictional biopic, I will add. Obviously, we don't know if any of this actually went down this way.
Is all true?
It's all is true, question mark, as you said earlier. But it's a kind of fascinating look at a remembered life from Ben Elton and Kenneth Branagh, Sir Kenneth Branagh.
Mr. Shakespeare, I don't want to pester you.
Good. Excellent news. Cheerio.
I just wanted to ask you...
The best way to get started as a writer is to start writing.
No, really, could I just...
Yeah, I don't have a favourite play. I admire all my fellow dramatists equally, and yes, I do think women should be allowed to perform the female roles, as is the practice on the continent now. Please, if you'll excuse me.
So I'm here with Sir Kenneth Branagh, and we will be talking about your new film, All Is True. And one of the first things I wanted to ask you is about the title, actually. Obviously, it has a lot of double meanings. It was the name of the original play, Henry VIII, and it could also relate to the kind of potentially fictional or semi-fictional aspects of the film. And I just wanted to know why you and Ben settled on that title and what it means to you.
Well, I'd call it a sort of Shakespearean title in the sense that he often wrote plays that appeared to stand back from a declaration. So you're Much Ado About Nothing, Twelfth Night, or What You Will, As You Like It, offering the audience the chance to take their own view. So when you write a history play like Henry VIII and you suggest its alternative title is All Is True, it's already some kind of the semi-ironic invitation to see, well, what do you think? And with all is true, I suppose, when we believed that we were going to be uncovering in our imagination of the gaps between the facts in the Shakespeare's lives, that we'd be uncovering emotions and passions that would be, at war with each other. The daughters and the wife and the husband might not all agree, but their voices all needed to be heard. And as far as they're concerned, everything that they say is perhaps right, correct, or so. All is true. All voices must be heard. That's how it struck me.
Nah, that definitely works for me as well. I love the kind of the meta kind of aspect of it, speaking to the audience in that way. So you've had a kind of lifelong, career-long relationship with William Shakespeare and his works. You've played some of his most famous characters and directed some of his most famous plays and films. And I just wanted to know, with this being part of a fictional kind of semi-fictional biopic, have you always been interested in Shakespeare the father, Shakespeare the husband, Shakespeare the man?
I've become more and more interested in the man behind the man from Stratford, anyway. Those facts we know about the school he went to, the father who was disgraced in business, this sense of incompleteness that may lie behind his decision to buy a coat of arms on his return to Stratford. The man who's been the most prominent writer of the age wants to return with a shield, a coat of arms that requires people to call him gentleman. It was £20 then, it probably cost you £3,000 or £4,000 now. It's a significant investment to make for that particular bit of whatever needs to be established. He might have said this is just business. Other people might have said that's your ego or your fragility. I was interested to know what that question sort of provoked in the story. That opportunity to sort of get behind the man from Stratford and also for an audience maybe provide a little context for the sort of ongoing and perfectly legit requirement to kind of understand why Shakespeare is relevant, why he should be listened to, and maybe understanding him as a man is a way of doing that.
Yeah, no, I can see that, and I also think that what it did for me in understanding him as a man, it changes your kind of perception of his body of work as well, which is for that to always be evolving and shifting, I think is really important for any artist. Mm-hmm. And was that important to you as well, to kind of look at the man behind the work?
Yes, I think, and as you say, the way in which we perceive the work changes. For me, it's been a lifelong journey to, from the beginning of encountering Shakespeare, of understanding. I come from a working class Irish background, and he was a rather intimidating cultural force. He was something that was told, that we were told was good for us, and expected to understand why that was the case. And I did not find an easy entry into understanding it initially. And so I'm grateful for anything that lets me have a way into just receiving it directly, not through some other sieve or some other kind of lens that tells me I have to be something before I can appreciate it. So that's really been a lifelong journey for me, actually, to find the way that Shakespeare, as he does to me when it works wonderfully well, gets directly to the heart, gets way, way, way beyond my head, way, way, way beyond words, and to a sort of place of experience that I think is a unique and beautiful feature of great art.
Oh, fantastic. And lastly, just about the physicality of the performance. Obviously, there's no evidence of this man and photographic evidence of what he looked like or his mannerisms. How did you approach the physicality of it?
The painting in the National Portrait Gallery by John Taylor, or attributed to John Taylor from about 1608, is the one that most evidence suggests could be Shakespeare, that he might have sat for it. And it's that image that I tried to be. Minus contact lenses. I have blue eyes. He had brown. I didn't want the barrier of a contact lens between those eyes to the soul, as it were. But I did want to try and create the sort of iconic image of Shakespeare that people think is going to be one thing, and then as soon as you start seeing him walking, moving, eating, speaking, and talking, becomes hopefully something else that's more human.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us, Sir Kenneth Branagh.
Thank you very much.
I haven't watched it yet, but I'm a sucker for Branagh. I'll check this out. I can't deny that. I just like the guy.
There's something really lovely when you go to see a Kenneth Branagh film. I don't feel anxious. I don't feel worried. He has a very uncynical approach to filmmaking, it seems.
He's a decaf tea at 9 o'clock.
And he loves it. And he feels great. And, you know, you feel very relaxed. I will always sing the praises of his 2015 adaptation of Cinderella, in which Lily James plays Cinderella. And it's, yeah, it's just also a very traditional adaptation, but, you know, they don't all make movies like that anymore. And
fun fact, Sam Howlett, who listeners will know, joined me in a morning viewing of Kenneth Branagh's Cinderella at the cinema by ourselves.
And you had a great time.
We did. We had a terrific time.
There we are.
Yeah, I think he's a traditionalist filmmaker in a lot of ways, and I think that's his wheelhouse, and that's, he loves being kind of in, he loves messing with kind of form a little bit, but this is a man who's played Poirot and played some of Shakespeare's greatest characters, and now he's playing Shakespeare himself. He reaches for the stars with these roles, and he feels like he fits in that kind of mold. And he does. He has such a great presence on stage and screen that it's hard to imagine anybody else kind of taking on the role of Shakespeare in the way that he does. It's a cheeky performance. It's a light performance. But there are also moments of real intensity that we've seen from Kenneth Branagh before.
Yeah. And it's written by Ben Elton, who on the small screen is writing a kind of comedy Shakespeare in the form of Upstart Crow with David Mitchell. But clearly he's got an affection for the character that can have more of a straight line to it.
Yeah, and you can tell in the film as well. I think these are two people who have written or researched Shakespeare quite extensively. And they know about as much as they can about him. We hear about kind of talking about going to the National Portrait Gallery just to look at a picture of Shakespeare and kind of get Shakespeare's personality from a picture. So, you know, you can see the efforts that they put in to kind of recreating this man's life. And it's fascinating. It's an outrageous prosthetic nose that he's wearing. But you know, not distracting after 5 minutes. You kind of get into the vibe of it. Yeah.
And I think like anyone who enjoyed Murder on the Orient Express, say maybe more than a Jack Ryan shadow recruit.
To be honest, anyone with a passing interest in Shakespeare will find something to like about this film. And you know, I think at this point, all of us have a passing interest in Shakespeare.
So everyone, yeah.
We like
it.
Fans
everyone.
Of the written word. All right. And yeah, you can check out All Is True at the cinema this weekend. But if you don't fancy it, you can always stay at home and watch something on Curzon Home Cinema. This week, we're doing a home cinema exclusive preview run of MechTube, My Love. It's not in cinemas. That will be next week. It's just on demand. That's the new film from the director of Blue is the Warmest Colour. And coming up, we're going to have Samuel Mirza's Venice Silver Lion winning Foxtrot. And you can head to Curzon blog to check out the trailer for that. Ella is doing the prayer hands emoji, but in real life, at the mention of that film.
So I saw Foxtrot completely on a whim at London Film Festival in 2017. And I've been keeping an eye on when it was going to come out because I wasn't expecting anything from this film. And it's just kind of mysterious, but consistently engaging and just amazing storytelling from a different place, frankly. It's an Israeli drama, and I'm really excited for it to be available in cinemas and on demand.
And along with those Soho memories, do send us any thoughts on If Beale Street Could Talk or All Is True as well. You can also do it by tweeting us at Curzon Cinemas as well. If it's your first time listening to the show, please do subscribe. You can do that on iTunes, Acast, Spotify, wherever you get your pods. And whilst you're there, leave us a review or a comment as well. Next week, we'll be talking about The Kid Who Would Be King, the long-awaited new film from Joe Cornish, the director of Attack the Block, and we'll be talking to Joe about it too. Stephen, you'll be taking that one.
Yeah, I'm interviewing him later today. Very excited about that.
Excellent. And you can keep up with Stephen on Letterboxd, not Twitter, at Hydra815, is that right?
Yeah, I'm going to change that.
Yeah?
But yeah, that's Hydra815.
Keep up with everything that you're watching. And you can keep up with us in the old-fashioned way on Twitter. Kelly, you're on Twitter at KS_pal?
Yes.
Yeah. Brilliant. Ella at
EFE Kemp.
And me at Jake H. Cunningham. And all that's left to do is say our bye bye. So it's bye bye from our Juliet.
Bye bye.
From our Rosalind.
Goodbye.
Say it, Jake.
And from the big dick.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.